Hey, you're listening to World Cafe. I'm Talia Schlanger. My guest today is a musical pioneer, a fiddle, guitar, banjo, and most notably, mandolin player, who some consider the godfather of newgrass music. It's Sam Bush. Sam is the subject of a documentary called Revival, The Sam Bush Story. It traces Sam's musical trajectory from this kid who grew up on country and bluegrass in Kentucky to one of the founders of the band Newgrass Revival to one of the key influencers in modern Americana. The film came out on the festival circuit in 2015. It was just released late last year on Amazon, and it features friends and admirers like Bela Fleck, Emmylou Harris, Chris Thiele of the Punch Brothers, Alison Krauss, and the Avett Brothers. And they all have really nice things to say about Sam Bush.
It was almost as if you're at your own wake without sounding odd about it. You know, I think growing up around acoustic music, we've learned to be really giving with each other. And that's part of the spirit of the whole film of the people. Yes, my pals that, you know, came to testify about me on camera. But also it's... I think it's part of the way we grew up playing and jamming together and sitting in a circle and learning to communicate. And maybe in that way, the world I grew up in, the world of acoustic music, that we all tend to support each other.
I'd love for you to share a couple of the stories that we hear told in the film, in Revival, The Sam Bush Story, starting with growing up in Bowling Green, Kentucky on a farm. Some of the artists that I talk to say that they had to, you know, rebel against their parents to make it in music, or that, you know, they had to sneak guitars into their bedrooms or hide records under their, you know, dressers. You had quite an opposite experience where your dad was really supportive. Tell me a little bit about how he influenced your early musical education.
Well, both our parents, my mom played guitar and Pop played the fiddle and the mandolin. And nobody loved fiddle playing more than my dad. I'd never met anyone that loved fiddling like him. He, as a farmer, they were both farmers, and so he is the farmer that loved the fiddle. He would invite other fiddlers and guitar players to come over to our house and have just kind of fiddle jam sessions. He loved that. And I was getting interested in playing the mandolin, and my father listened to fiddle records by Tommy Jackson, the great Grand Ole Opry fiddler. And so on the fiddle tunes would also be a mandolin playing along with the fiddle. So I guess somewhere along the line, I love the sound of the fiddle and the mandolin playing in unison together.
So, Sam, your dad not only introduced you to this wonderful music, but he also helped you get on stage at the Opry for the very first time, like when you were really young. Would you tell me how that happened?
Yes. At the time, down on Broadway in Nashville, Mr. Roy Acuff had, you know, toured the world so many years at this point. It takes us up to the 70s when Mr. Acuff started the Acuff Museum and Exhibit. And so my dad and I came down, I guess I was somewhere around 13 or 14, came down from Bowling Green to Nashville. It's about 60 miles. And we went in on a Saturday afternoon, and lo and behold, taking admission for the Roy Acuff exhibit was Bashful Brother Oswald, Roy's right-hand man on dobro and banjo. And, you know, we were fans. And Bashful Brother Oswald's taking the door. And, of course, my dad's a real friendly guy, and he and Oswald struck up a conversation that they were friends the rest of their lives after that. It was great. Mm-hmm. And my dad told Oswald that I played the fiddle. So Oz went and found a fiddle, and I played a little tune for him. And he immediately got right on the telephone, called Mr. Acuff, and said, "Roy, you better get down here. We got a boy that can fiddle." So Mr. Acuff came down, and later that night put me on the show that came on at midnight on WSM radio after the Grand Ole Opry. And I was, you know, just totally freaked out, in awe. I mean, I got to be backstage at the Ryman Auditorium, and it was, the whole thing was pretty surreal. But then, now we've made the acquaintance of Mr. Acuff and they loved to have fiddle jams between all his Opry performances. So I would get to hang out with the great fiddle player, Howdy Forrester, that was Roy's fiddle player and one of the greatest that ever drew a bow. And so it was after a couple of years of getting to come down, my dad and I were standing there on a Friday night backstage at the Ryman Auditorium. And unbeknownst to me, Mr. Acuff went up to my dad and said, go get his fiddle. I'm going to put him on. I want him to play a tune. So all of a sudden, my dad walked up with the fiddle and the bow out of the case. He said, Roy's putting you on. What do you want to play? And, I didn't know. I didn't have time to think. I didn't have time to get nervous. And so I believe that night I played a tune called The Drunken Billy Goat. That Mr. Acuff particularly liked, so I played that one. And so I guess I was 16 when Mr. Acuff let me play on the Grand Ole Opry.
And then he actually, Roy Acuff, who was known as the king of country music, the year you graduated high school in 1970, actually offered you a job through your dad to play in mm-hmm. his band. And that, I mean, to your dad, who thought of him as a hero, that had to be just the biggest deal in the world. And then you gave a really surprising answer.
Well, it was the biggest deal in the world to my dad because, you know, me being 18 years old in 1970, let's see, my heroes were Bill Monroe, Eric Clapton, The Byrds, you know, just it's a different generation. Yeah. My father's heroes were Roy Acuff and Hank Williams, Hawkshaw Hawkins, Patsy Cline, Cowboy Copas. He loved all those people. So, yes, for my father to hear that, you know, for Mr. Acuff to offer me a job through my dad, well, of course, my dad thought I should immediately take that. Well, I was 18, and I was in love with the idea of bluegrass music and mandolin, and it just wasn't the right thing. And honestly, I didn't want to play in a band with people that were my father's age. And another thing was that the first trip they took was to Vietnam. And in 1970, at age 18, I was scared to death the thought of being in Vietnam under any circumstances. So that too, just, it wasn't appealing. And I moved up to Louisville and started playing in the Bluegrass Alliance five or six nights a week, playing at the Red Dog Saloon. And that's what we call going to Bluegrass College.
What'd you learn at Bluegrass College?
I learned that you got to play really fast and furious in a really crowded bar. I think we learned to play as hard as we could on acoustic instruments. And what we did learn, though, was to get tough playing in front of an audience.
Let's pick out a Bluegrass Alliance tune.
Well, I never actually recorded with them. One of their favorite tunes, my favorite tunes that they did, was their version, the Bluegrass Alliance did, of Bob Dylan's song, You Ain't Going Nowhere.
So Bluegrass Alliance is what you called, I guess, your bluegrass education. Mm-hmm. And then eventually you go on to sort of flip the genre on its head and break ground and do the thing that I think has defined the way that we think about you as this innovative musician, which is forming the band Newgrass Revival.
Well, that came out. We were the Bluegrass Alliance was a five-piece band, and we came to a a parting of the ways with our fiddle player, and we wanted him to leave the band. Well, that's when we found out he owned the name of the band, and so leaving the rest of us to go, well, I guess we all quit then. So in that way, four guys quit a five-piece band, and that so we just started and tried to find a band name. With the words Newgrass Revival, what it meant to us is that we were kind of continuing on a style that already was going. The people that had made new bluegrass, like the Osbournes and the Dillards and Jim and Jesse. And so we just felt like we were kind of reviving what they already started. So we never claimed that we were the first ones to play a new kind of bluegrass. We just felt like we were helping revive the style and keep it going.
Yeah. Well, revival, though, is sort of, as a word, sets up this tension, I guess, that plays out throughout the documentary and what you did in Newgrass Revival with Bela Fleck and John Cowan and Pat Flynn. Your band name basically sort of calls out that there's a change happening and that maybe the heroes who you all got into music because of did one thing and that it's morphing into another. So tell me a little bit about, I guess, the tension that you might have felt in those early Newgrass Revival dates between the people you loved and where you were going.
Well, the other musicians always treated us great. We were totally accepted by the musicians. And I think one of the reasons that we were is because everybody knew we knew how to play bluegrass and that we respected the roots. I mean, nobody loves Bill Monroe more than me and respected the roots of it, but there was no reason for us to play like them anymore. We knew right off the bat that we weren't suited just for old-time bluegrass festivals. And then when we did play certain bluegrass festivals, they would tend to put us on at midnight. And one promoter who was particularly good to us named Carlton Haney, we'd ask, Carlton, couldn't we play a little earlier? And he'd say, well, you could, boys, but that's when y'all people are awake. So we were kind of like the late-night jam band.
Let's have a listen to what you were doing. Pick out a song, would you, from your first album, maybe, from Newgrass Revival, self-titled 1972 debut?
Well, first album, I think it actually might have started off with this tune. A friend of ours from Louisville wrote it, and it wasn't like any other tune we ever heard at the time, called Pennies in My Pockets.
Pennies in my pockets, I got pennies in my shoes. I got pennies to trade for lemonade, I got pennies just to lose. I don't like them when they're shiny, only like them when they're brown. I like to have a lot to roll and I love the way they sound. Going for a ride on the freeway, I wish a clover leaf would take us underneath what we say. Wake us up when we get old, tamper when we reach the end of the road.
Sam Bush is my guest here on the World Cafe, and we're talking about a documentary called Revival, The Sam Bush Story. Let's talk a bit about the signature mandolin sound that you are known for. I guess described by some people as chop and sweep. It's rhythmically unlike anything else. And maybe before we talk about how you developed that sound, you can tell me if there's a piece of recorded material that you think really exemplifies what that is.
Perhaps, yeah, because I tried to learn to make it a whole different thing. There's a song, written by Peter Rowan that Newgrass Revival did, simply called Revival. And there's a little sort of a what we call the mandolin percussion solo. Part of it came from, the loves of learning to play drums in the marching band. Well, one drum at a time. Drums in the marching band and learning about rudiments and what happens. And then the chop of the mandolin, what we call the mandolin chop, I think you can pretty much see where that developed with Mr. Bill Monroe. And somewhere around the late 50s, early 60s, he started making a percussive backbeat chop where he wasn't just strumming rhythm anymore.
You gone so far away, my darling. Each time I think of you, I cry. I press your picture to my bosom, so I know we'll be close by.
And so all us bluegrass mandolin players, we all, with the exception of Jesse McReynolds, I think we've all tried to copy Bill Monroe's chop. And then years later, of all things, say about 1975, 76, when I heard the first record that turned me on by Bob Marley and the Wailers, it was Natty Dread, and the rhythm guitar playing in reggae music just, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I loved it. And really, it was Bob Marley personally playing that rhythm guitar that I loved. And that attracted me to reggae music because it reminded me of Bill Monroe's mandolin chop. So just rhythm playing to me is, it's everything. And that's what I hope when I play with people that they can take away of knowing that when you solo, I'm going to give you good rhythm.
At your peak in the film, we see this question on the cover of Fretz magazine. And it says, are Nashville's virtuosos too good for gold? And you say in the movie that this is sort of a general topic that magazines would ask you guys all the time about your musical proficiency and whether that got in the way of commercial success. I imagine that would be such a weird thing to swallow or a hard thing to swallow. But I think it says something really important about what you guys did and even maybe the way that we hear music now. So what did you make of that at that time?
Well, I think we took great pride in it because even Mr. Jim Fogel's song, the head of Capitol who Records here in Nashville, who signed us, and he actually told us, he goes, I love what you guys do, and I don't want you to change. It's up to you. Don't change anything. Change whatever you want. But he said, you guys make the music. We'll try to sell it. And I guess in a way, and so Capitol would tell us, yeah, you guys are our – you're our integrity group. You're the group that gives us musical integrity.
Wow.
So then that would always make me wonder, does that mean we're not going to sell anything? But, you know, when you look at the time in the late 80s, and seemingly the country market was the one we should have gone in. That's been debated as an afterthought years later. Gee, should they have been sold more in the rock and roll market? I'm not sure. I just know that we went along and we made a living and we had an audience. And in that way, I always felt we were successful. And so I think for us to, I think our highest charting single in the country radio got to 36 maybe with Calling Baton Rouge. And probably could have gone higher, but Capitol Records found out we were breaking up and they stopped the promo.
Did people say that you were crazy to break up as a band at the time that you were having your highest charting single with Calling Baton Rouge and where you were at the time?
Sure. I mean, it happened when it was time for it to stop, in that we, maybe we'd taken our music with the four of us as far as we could go. One of the things that was occurring is that Bela Fleck is just, you know, of course, one of the most talented musicians on the earth. And he was writing so many tunes that we couldn't accommodate his writing. He needed to go on and express himself with the Flecktones. And the first time I heard him play with the band that would become the Flecktones, I knew he had found his space. It was great. And so Bela was going on, and then that left John and I really as the duet singers, as the singers, to think a lot about if we wanted to go on with it. And he and I both thought we needed to do something different. We both needed a different scene. And so for me, I had no plan when the band broke up, other than I was really was hoping to stop traveling. All I'd ever done was travel since I got out of high school. So, but that didn't happen because Emmylou Harris called up with the idea of starting an acoustic band, and lo and behold, I ended up in Emmylou's band, the Nash Ramblers, for the next 5 years.
What's a Nash Ramblers song that you treasure from that time?
Quite a few of them, because when we made our Live at the Ryman album, that was truly Emmy just gave all the band a lot of input into the material and the arrangements, and we worked them up together, and it was just such a labor of love that we went through for that record. And so I guess one of my favorites would be then this one. I got to suggest this song that we work it up, which was a Bill Munro tune, The Walls of Time.
Yeah, this is circa 92. Is here with me on the World Cafe, and we're talking about the documentary about him called Revival, The Sam Bush Story. The film made me think so much about what success is, because it spans your career up until now. And there are so many different metrics that come up, like success is being influential on younger generations, and success is earning the respect of your peers and your elders, and success is having friends, success is doing what you love, having your health, being able to make a living. I mean, I'm wondering if the process of being part of this documentary changed the way that you define success for yourself at all.
I don't think so, because success, okay, now one flip answer is success, being able to buy two pair of blue jeans at the same time. That's pretty good. But really, I just think... success doesn't always translate into, you know, where I am in show business or the amount of money that I'm trying to make. For me, success means that I am free to play the music I choose.
Yeah. One of the things that you grapple with in the movie is the idea of being relevant. How do you stay relevant? And you say this great quote, you say that you're too young to, or too old to be young, and too young to be an old legend. So where does that
this
leave?
This is true.
What does that say, I guess, or where does that leave you now as somebody who's a working musician and then also a subject of a documentary about how influential you are? Where does that leave you now?
It's kind of an odd thing, because as you and I talk, I'm 66 years old, and that's just hard to, you know, how'd you get that far? I mean, we say it in a song Jeff Black and I wrote, the song called Circles Around Me. How in the world did we get this far? And because I mean, in so many ways, I feel like I'm still learning, and I'm just trying to get better. I'm trying to get better as a singer and player.
Well, let's go out on Circles Around Me, and I'm glad that wherever you've been has landed you here today, and I'm thankful to you, Sam, for talking to me on the show.
Thank you, Talia. I'm thankful to be with you.
Here we go, Sam Bush.
We were riding down through the grapevine,
when I heard someone say your name. Hand on my shoulder, just a little bit older now, and I remember everything. High in Telluride, up on Bridal Veil, 10,000 feet above the sound. The news came around and sent me to count on my blessings and to thank you for all the good friends that I found. Hey, 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 how in the world did we get this far? Hey, 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 holding tight to the tail of a shooting star. Hey, 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 you're running circles around me, circles around me now.
That is Circles Around Me, the title track to Sam Bush's 2009 record. Sam's documentary called Revival, The Sam Bush Story, is out on Amazon now. Thanks so much to Sam for coming in to talk. And thanks to Sam for influencing so many bands that we now know and love, including the Punch Brothers, the Avett Brothers, both of whom are in that documentary. All right. Thanks, Sam Bush. Thanks to our senior producer, Kimberly Junod. Thanks to Kaleo, who's with me in studio right now, engineering. Thanks.
You're welcome.
I'm Talia Schlanger, and this is The World Cafe from NPR.